I'd like to begin with a prayer and then to tell you a couple jokes before we move into it. This is a prayer from Frederick Buechner's book, The Darkening, or The Hungering Dark. O God in Christ, there is no ground anywhere that is not holy ground. For in the cool of the evening, you walked upon it, and in the heat of the day, you died upon it. And at the coming of dawn, you return, and are always and everywhere returning to it, and to us who walk upon it too. This holy ground, though heedless of its holiness. O make us whole, set us free. You shaped us each in the darkness of a womb to give us life, and you know us each by name, and not one is forgotten by you, not one but is precious in your sight. The ugly with the beautiful, the criminal with the child, the enemy with the friend. Lord, give me eyes to see each other and ourselves more nearly as you see us, to see beneath each face we meet, and beneath even our own faces, your face. Help us to know that for each you have died as though he were the only one, or she. Amen.
Amen.
That touches some of the things that we want to talk about today. The jokes I have are, I thought of these actually because of what we were talking about last night with Eucharist, communion, eating, all that. And the first one is the story of a priest. Now, I heard this as really a true story, but then someone told me they heard another version of this. But I heard it was a newly ordained priest in the Chicago diocese who was eager to really get out and be active. He had learned all these things now, and he really wanted to be a priest who's really with it. And so he came into this new parish, and he wasn't there a week, and one of the parishioners approached him and asked him whether he would say a mass in her home, and then they would invite the rest of the neighbors to this mass. And that was just about when that was starting to come. That was quite a new thing, as you know. And so he said, oh, by all means, he would be delighted to come. And she said, well, what should I have ready? And he said, well, don't worry about it. He said, just have some wine and a little bread, and that's all we need. And so they came together, and he got there at the right time, and the neighbors were all congregated, and she positioned him at this place in the Davenport in the little table, and there she had a glass of wine, and on the little plate she had a piece of raisin bread. And saw the bread, and he kind of, you know, pulled back, and she said, is that okay, Father? She said, that's the only bread I had in the house, and you said a piece of bread, will that be okay? And he didn't want her to feel badly, you know. And so he said, no, that'll be okay, that'll be all right. So they started the Mass, and he seemed a little faint, you know, but anyway, he went on with the Mass, and he came to the words of consecration. And he held up the bread, and he said, this, except for the raisins. The body of Christ. So, we haven't quite gotten to the place where we include the raisins, but maybe there are raisins in our own experience we have to begin to include. The other is a story of two priests who were newly ordained, and from the money that they received from relatives and friends, decided to go over to Rome and spend a week just touring and seeing the Vatican and doing various things. And so they were there three or four days and really enjoying the food and the sunshine and all the things and the wonderful Italian culture. And one of them said to the other about midweek, you know, I really enjoy this, and I like Italian food, I really do. And you know, we've had pizza and we've had spaghetti, and he said, and ravioli, I'm really enjoying all of this, but you know what I'd really like is just one good juicy steak. And the other one said, well, maybe I can do something about that. So the next day when they met to go touring, one of them said, he said, you won't believe what I have underneath my cassock. He said, in one hand I have two juicy steaks, and in the other I have a hibachi. And we're going to go to the Vatican Gardens this afternoon, and we're going to cook these up. And the other priest said, gosh, he said, I don't think we better do that. There are all kinds of signs around, you know, do not enter and keep out. He said, we could get in big, big trouble, you know. He said, oh, he said, don't worry. He said, you know, the Pope is just a very, very with it guy, you know. He used to play guitar when he was in Poland. He used to say, he said, he's a really with it guy, and if he saw us in the Vatican Gardens, he'd probably just come over, bless us, bless the food, tell us to enjoy it, and he said, he won't mind one bit. And it's a big garden, and there's lots of space, and the other one didn't know about it, but he thought, well, okay, he'd go along with it. So, sure enough, they scrambled over the wall about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and getting all settled, and boy, the coals were just getting nice and hot, ready to put the steak on, and there they saw the Pope in his white cassock coming down. Well, the one who wasn't so sure about this just couldn't take the, and so he ran and hid it behind a bush. I guess he went on this side over here. And so he watched, though. And he watched, and Pope came down very slowly saying his rosary and got near to the other priest who was cooking this, and like this, turned around and went down the walk. Priest behind the bush came running out, and he said, God, he said, that's wonderful. It's just like you said, the Pope came, blessed it, probably told us to have a good meal, and boy, he said, that's just wonderful. He's all ready to sit down, and the other guy said, not so fast. He said, that isn't exactly what he said. He said, well, what did he say? I saw him make the sign of the cross. He said, yeah. He said, I want you to take this hibachi and that friend over there and get the hell out of here. Sometimes the ritual doesn't go with the words, you know. So I thought we'd begin with a little review here and then a little overview, and then we'll dig in here. We talked last night about the three ways of perceiving. We could talk about the three kinds of perceivers, or it's a way to do it. And I was thinking about the Gospel of Mark again, and you could see the disciples through this gospel as pretty much concrete thinkers. You know, when Jesus says, you feed them, referring to the crowds who were hungry and with him all day, the disciples said, well, damn, we were calculating the money, you know, trying to see how much it would cost. It seems John the Baptist would represent someone on that second level, the way of the two. It was really John the Baptist and God, the voice in the wilderness. You see John the Baptist as a loner. He's really with God, but not with people. He eats alone. Of course, how many people want to eat grasshoppers and wild honey? And, you know, there is, that's the first reference to food in the text, grasshoppers. Or locusts and wild honey. It's not the ordinary fare of ordinary people. And you see that John the Baptist separates those who repent from those who don't. There's some harsh words that come in the Q material that we have in Matthew and in Luke. So John kind of represents, it seems to me, that the way of the two. But Jesus represents that third and deeper level, where Jesus embraces those who have been marginalized. He embraces both the rich and the poor. He eats with sinners, with those who are not accepted, not thought to be clean. And I think what you see, therefore, is that in the religious structure of Jesus' time, which was built upon the ethos of holiness as separation, Jesus really cuts against that or undergirds that or undermines that. When he eats with sinners, he violates the system of holiness as separation. And he does that almost, you would think, throughout this gospel. He's really strong in breaking down those barriers between Jew and Gentile, male and female, all the way throughout this gospel. I was sharing that at the last place I gave this little piece, and one of the professors, who was a very good friend of mine, afterwards said to me she was going to bring this up, that she thought there was a real danger of that being anti-Semitic, that it's Christians, of course, who do not make those kind of distinctions, which are really strong within the Jewish community of holy and unholy, or clean and unclean. But as a matter of fact, Christians have adopted that same ritual space of holy, unholy, in many, many ways. We use that. But more deeply is this. The only way you can do that is if you identify Jesus as Christian. But he's not Christian, he's Jewish. It's really important to see that Jesus, throughout the gospel tradition, is Jewish. He never ate a ham sandwich in his life. He abided by, I mean, that's where his material comes from, his tradition. That's what he comes out of, is that tradition. So he, as you know, the biblical tradition is varied. Every tradition has its continuities, and he would have his predecessors in there. So just thought I would make that point. Now, in the booklets I gave you last night, if you'd look in the front cover, the interesting diagram.
Are there any other copies of this to do?
You know there aren't, but...
That's fine. I can look on.
Can you look on?
Yeah.
I thought I had some, but I guess I don't. Now, in the inside cover, this is taken from... a book, I should have that on here, sorry I don't. It's Narrative Space and Mythic Meaning in Mark.
It's a pretty technical study, although it's very readable. Narrative Space and Mythic Meaning in Mark. And it's by Elizabeth.
It's in the bibliography.
Oh, do I have it in there?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, isn't that smarter than I thought? That's wonderful. Elizabeth Struthers Melbourne. Okay, so I do have it in there. Great, thank you so much. The bibliography is in the back of this, the last page. You'll see.
Thanks so much for reminding me of that. At any rate, this then is a summary chart in which what she does is study space, references to space in the Gospel of Mark, and finds that the space always is in terms of opposites, as here, heaven, earth, with a mediating mythic place, in this case, the mountain. So you have heaven, earth, but then the mountain becomes an important place for the teaching of Jesus and for where he is and place, okay. Then another one you have is the Jewish homeland and then the foreign lands. And then there are boundaries. And Jesus, say, in the story of the Gerasene demoniac, when he crosses from one side of the Sea of Galilee to the other, he's crossing a boundary there. He's going from the Jewish lands to the non-Jewish lands or the foreign lands. So that throughout this gospel, what you see is you have these pair of opposites, but Jesus mediates those constantly. The one down below, well, I guess the second one I should have followed if you went straight through would be land and sea, And then the earth becomes a mediating symbol there. And the political divisions and then the physical divisions. One of the most interesting ones I think she works with is the physical division between the outside and the inside, where the tomb becomes the mediating symbol. And then also, the buildings, residential and religious. So Jesus teaches in his house, as over against the synagogues, and all the way. The door in a house, you have the interior and the exterior, and the door becomes then symbolic in that as a mediator between the inside and the outside. So all of those terms become really ways of looking at relationships spelled out within this gospel, which is really interesting. Now, if you follow it through, if you take right in the middle here, I put a yellow streak through on, but in the middle of it, you see that the mediating symbol throughout the gospel comes out to be the way. The disciples are on the way. And on the way, they said to Jesus. And it seems to me that's such a wonderful symbol for journey, for both male and female journeys, is that what we're in is a process. But we're never at the end. It's always, and even death then becomes a way. You know, it's not the end, but rather, again, it's part of the journey or part of the way. So I just wanted to say that there's some pretty sophisticated research that would suggest that this is a gospel that really mediates opposites, and I think brings us then to that third level, the mythological level, as Jesus is the one who mediates through that kind of symbol. I just thought that would be a nice way to review some of those things that we talked about last night. Now, what I want to talk about today, just very briefly to tell you and then go back, would be to talk about the two basic approaches to the biblical text, which would be literary and historical, and some of the new material coming out from literary critics, and then also the new work being done in the historical area, particularly in sociological research. And then we'll look at two of the big things, honor, shame, as really significant to that culture, to the culture of Jesus, and kinship. So I'll give you some data on that. And then from there we'll move into the moments of a woman's journey as found in the writings of Carol Christ in a book she has called Diving Deep and Surfacing, which I found very useful. And I'll give you then examples of those four moments within the woman's journey, both some secular examples, if you will, and then from the Gospel of Mark, of how I think the Gospel of Mark can be used to help a woman get in touch with her story. And then we'll have, following that, I'll have you do an activity of taking a story from Mark and see whether we can pull out those moments in the story. And then we'll have a time at the end for sharing and questioning of that, if that's okay with you. Let me go back. The two basic approaches to the Bible as either literary or historical. Modern biblical criticism is primarily historical in its approach. It's been interested in grounding and giving evidence for our reading of the text. So it gets at, say, the sources of the Gospel of Mark, whether there are any sources, where there was any which is the earliest gospel? See, those are the questions that pretty much shaped biblical scholarship for a long, long time. And then probably in the last 20 years, there's been here and there people who got their training in literary criticism and then looked at the biblical text in terms of that criticism. The text becomes really nice for looking at, say, narratives or tales, and that becomes really good material. You perhaps heard of the book by Robert Alter. They have it in the, I think, both in the library here and also in the bookstore, The Art of Biblical Narrative, Then he also has one on biblical poetry. And there's a really fine book which I'd recommend to you, though it's pretty technical, by Mira Sternberg. Now, I know I don't think I put that on in here, but you scholarly types might be quite interested in that if you haven't heard about it already. Mira Sternberg, who actually is a Israeli Hebrew scholar. And so the book is on the Hebrew scriptures. But that's been a very important book for pulling together. He's been working at this for about 20 years and pulls together some really important stuff.
What's the name of it?
Oh, thank you. The name is The Poetics of Biblical Narrative. That's what it's called. The Poetics of Biblical Narrative. And it's a wonderful book because he's able to take a story that's probably about 5 lines long or 10 lines from the, say, Hebrew scriptures, and able to write about that for about 5 pages. he just keeps on pulling out the richness of the text. It's just really quite wonderful how he does that. What I'm interested in terms of the literary, is how we've now asked ourselves questions about meaning, where the meaning is. In other words, the literary studies have really also drawn us to think more about hermeneutics, the process of understanding. The old model, it seems, that we followed for inspiration gives us an idea of where we thought meaning came from. That is, God had a message that was given to a prophet who wrote it down into a text, which is now the inspired text, if you will, and other people would be involved. But it's kind of God from the top down to someone who wrote it down. I have a picture, for instance, maybe you've seen this, I think it's a Rembrandt, of Matthew, the evangelist Matthew. He's sitting, a pretty bulky figure, you know, sitting there, and there's a little light, and he's writing, the Holy Spirit is whispering in his ears, see? So it goes from God to the writer, the biblical writer, to the text, and now it's kind of encoded in the text, and then the priest or the pastor or the teacher then tells you what is the meaning of the text down to the reader. So there's kind of a message and it's handed down. But that process, which is a hierarchical model, doesn't really imitate the process itself of reading. So there's a book called The Art of Reading. The author's name is Isser, I-S-E-R. I don't have it on the list again. It's a pretty technical study, but what he suggests is this, that meaning is not in the text, and it's not in the reader. But you have those two poles, if you will. You have the text, which is a series of signals, and then you have a reader who somehow must interact with those signals, and the meaning then is created by the reader by interacting with the text. So that's what the meaning of that sentence is. Readers make sense, or meaning is created. It's a process. The text by itself doesn't have meaning in it. You have to have that kind of... Now, the reason I think that should be important, we need to hold on to that, is that then it makes a difference who the reader is. That is to say, if the reader becomes important in the process, then whether you're male or whether you're female will make a difference in how you enact the text, how you make sense of the text. And if text are primarily written by men, then men would have a good head start on that. And that's why many scholars now talk about deconstruction, because what you do is you look at a text and you say that what was intended by the text sometimes is undermined by the text itself, of how a text unravels itself. In terms of women, it means something like this. I got it. Who was? Seinen is, let's see. Here, I have it in another place. But there's an article, or a chapter actually, a book called, and the chapter is called Reading as a Woman. And what the literary critic suggests is that educated women were expected to read as if they were men. They were to disassociate themselves from being women. And they were encouraged, of course, to think like a man. I remember a friend of mine once, this was years ago, said, she's a sister, she said, I never read a book by a woman. I teased her about that recently and she told me that she's moved away from that, of course. But so part of what we're looking at here, if we're going to talk about reading, the process of reading, then I think becoming aware of our gender becomes an important process for everything, but primarily, it seems, for the biblical text. So that women do not disassociate themselves from their experience, but somehow how that text can put them in touch with their experience. That's what the scripture should do. It's put us in touch with ourselves. So that's one piece that I think is really very useful and very helpful. Out of the historical approach to the Bible, what I think is most exciting right now is the sociological material coming out, or the anthropological studies. And there are two things I wanted to share with you on that. One is on honor shame societies, the importance of honor and shame or what that means. And then we'll look at some kinship things coming out of these studies. Now, the work I'm using is from Richard Rohrbach, who teaches at Lewis and Clark in Portland, Oregon. I think he is a Lutheran pastor. I think that's what his background is. I'm not sure. At any rate, he's done a lot of this research, and Bruce Molina is another name who's done work along this line. So I'm going to just read a little section because it's a nice summary. It says, unlike our Western guilt-oriented society, the pivotal value of the agrarian society of the first century was honor-shame. As in the traditional Middle Eastern society of today, so in biblical times, honor meant everything, including survival. The word is all, their words are translated from the Hebrew meaning honor, and it has that same kind of meaning of something weighty or heavy or important. Honor can be understood as the status quo one claims in the community, together with the recognition of one's claim by others. Challenges to one's honor could be positive or negative. Giving a gift is a positive challenge and requires reciprocation in kind. An insult is a negative challenge and response is deadly serious and can literally be a matter of life and death. So, honor shame. When people interact with you, they are either honoring you, and then you respond to them in a like way, or they dishonor you, and then you have to defend yourself. It must be played in every area of life, and every person in the village watches to see how each family defends and maintains its position. Since status determines whom you marry, with whom you can do business, what functions you can attend, where you can live, and even what religious role you can play, it must be defended at all costs. The smallest slight or injury must be avenged, or honor is permanently lost. Moreover, because the family is the basic unit in traditional societies rather than the individual, having a blackened face, which is an Arabic expression, can destroy the well-being of an entire kin group. And so one member can lose honor for the entire group to whom or with whom that person is associated. Honor can be ascribed or acquired. Ascribed honor derives from birth. Being born into an honorable family makes one honorable in the eyes of the entire community. Acquired honor, by contrast, is the result of skill in the never-ending game of challenge and response. Not only must one win to gain it, one must do so in public, because the whole community must acknowledge the gain. To claim honor the community does not recognize is to play the fool. So it's always a public thing. It also is important not to misunderstand the notion of shame. Shame is not a negative. It can be understood as a sensitivity for one's honor. So a shameless person is a person who has no sensitivity to insult. So to have shame means that you're sensitive and alert to honor or dishonor. In a certain sense, men are related to honor, and women are the ones who are to protect that. They're related to shame. It's just interesting in how that works. It says, people without shame, without this needed sensitivity to what is going on, make fools of themselves in public. Certain people, such as prostitutes, tavern owners, and actors, were considered irreversibly shameless in antiquity because they did not respect the boundaries or norms of the honor system and thus threatened social chaos. Finally, women, who usually played the shame role in agrarian societies, were expected to have this sensitivity in a special way and to teach it to their children. One way that women control the, have a lot of influence on honor shame is gossip. So that they are able, by the sharing that they do, to put people in their place or keep people in their place. It's really interesting. So they share that. Now it's interesting when you know this, you probably know this too. When you hear, say with the Americans now in the Gulf, when you have specialists in Middle Eastern studies coming to share, say in public forums, on television for instance, one of the things that they always refer to is the issue of honor and shame. Before January 15th, I listened particularly to hear that one of the things they begged the Americans to do is not to shame Saddam Hussein, that they should not negotiate with him without leaving him a way to save face. It's a cultural thing. Now, along that line, it's rather sad to see that we have so little understanding for those who are making these decisions in our country. This is a State Department official said this: our aim hasn't been to remove him, but we do intend to defeat him in some kind of humiliating fashion. We don't plan to treat him with any respect. Now, in terms of his culture, it would be preferable for him to die. He would save honor. But to be shamed so completely is just the wrong thing to do. And it would be interesting to see how we're going to deal with the results, how we're going to deal diplomatically with what we're doing. It would be very interesting to see that. Now, of course, what I'm interested in seeing is how then, when you read a biblical text, all those issues of honor, shame are involved in almost every text you read. And that Jesus spent time with a lot of people who have been who were with honor in their society. And one of the things that he does in the healings is to restore to them honor and then their place within the community. At the same time, you could see that in this gospel, when Jesus dies on the cross, they have made an attempt to take every bit of honor from him. That he dies without honor. I mean, as far as their culture could do it, he dies in utter disgrace. So that it's no wonder then that the words of Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me, would be the way he must have felt. Not, say, a religious, I'm not saying that means he died in despair, but certainly those words, which are the words of a psalm, as you know, would really express how utterly abandoned he must have felt within that culture. So that's a really, really important piece that I think modern scholars are giving us, or recent scholarship. This is another on kinship. Kinship norms regulate human relationships within and among family groups. At each stage of life, from birth to death, these norms determine the roles we play and the ways we interact with one another. Moreover, what it meant to be a father, mother, husband, wife, sister, or brother was vastly different in ancient agrarian societies than what we know in the modern industrial world. Note, for example, he says, the list in Leviticus, chapters 18 and 20, all about these kinship relationships. By New Testament times, these had become lists of prohibited marriage partners. They include a variety of in-laws for whom we do not prohibit marriage today. For example, he says, see Mark 6:18. Moreover, for us, marriage is generally neo-local. That is, a new residence is established by the bride and groom, and they're exogamous, they're outside the kin group. In antiquity, it was patrilocal. The bride moved in with her husband's family. And endonymous, marrying as close to the conjugal family as incest laws permitted. Cross-cousin marriages on the paternal side of the family were the ideal. And genealogies always followed the paternal line of descent. Since marriages were fundamentally the fusion of two extended families, honor played a key role. Marriage contracts negotiated the fine points and ensured balanced reciprocity. I mean, it would be nice if you'd have a family, say, that had honor and would marry a family that didn't have honor. But you see, they wouldn't do that, because one family then would be losing honor and the other would be gaining it, and that wouldn't be fair. It's my mother's solution to poverty, by the way. Every rich person, she says, should marry a poor person, and then things would balance out. She says, unfortunately, rich people marry rich people. That doesn't help, she says. Well, you have the same thing here in terms of honor. So they really very carefully judge. See, we do it in terms of money. I think it is true. You know, we do it in terms of economics more. But for them, it was the honor that a family had. Since the family was the producing unit of antiquity, rather than the consuming unit as in our society, the loss of a member through marriage required compensation in the form of a bride price. By far, the strongest unit of loyalty was the descent group of brothers and sisters, see, the blood relationship. And it was here, rather than between husband and wife, that the strongest emotional ties existed. Socially and psychologically, all family members were embedded in the family unit. Our individualism simply did not exist. That means that when we look at, say, the healing stories in the fourth session, the individual healed is really a symbol for the whole. So it's never as an individual person that the person is, you know, remembers, not as an individual. But that individual becomes a symbol for the rest in that group. The public role was played by the males on behalf of the whole unit, while females played the private internal role that often included management of the family purse. Females not embedded in a male, widows, divorcees, were women without honor and often viewed as more male than female by the society. That's interesting. I'll read you a couple more here. This is on the wife. In antiquity, all persons, but especially women, were socially, religiously, economically, and psychologically embedded in the husband's family. It was a paternal family. All members contributed to the well-being of the whole. In some degree, a marriage disembedded a woman from her family of birth and embedded her in that of her new husband. Betrothal, sealed by the contract, began that process, and moving to the husband's home after the wedding completed it. Now remember, a lot of the marriages would have been prearranged. The children could be 3, 4 years old. And those would already be arranged marriages. Also, so the marriage, the girl could be maybe 12 or 13 when she would get married, huh? When she would be beyond puberty to have children. The other thing to keep in mind is that many people did not live to the age 30. So that if it looks like they were rushed, it's because their lifespan was so terribly, terribly small. I'm going to share some of that material with you again when we look at healing, see why healing was so important in their world, because of how much, how limited their lives were, and then how sickness was such a part of their life. We're in hospitals and that sort of thing, you know. So you see that. It says, nevertheless, a wife remained, for the most part, on the periphery of her husband's family. She would be perceived as a stranger, an outsider, by everyone in the house. Now, can you imagine a young girl, 12, 13 years old, married, and she goes to this new family now, her husband's family, and she's an outsider. Only after the birth of a son would that diminish. Doesn't say it destroys it. She will always be an outsider. But she has a hold on the family once she has a son, because she then has a blood relationship on which to depend. A son would be her closest emotional support and would, along with her own brothers and father, defend her against her husband or the father-in-law and the mother-in-law. Of course, if she went to that home, her husband's family, her mother-in-law would be the one in charge in that house. So just interesting to see where all those relationships come. Finally, it says, in the eyes of both her husband's family and a whole village, she would remain a stranger in her husband's house until a child was born. And so you can see why a woman being barren within the Old Testament, or Elizabeth, and all of that becomes really very potent material for reflection. So it gives you some kind of sense of the importance of that. Now there's a lot of new material on that, but that'll give us some background here. Yes, Tim.
I just was wondering where that piece was from.
Well, this is actually for a commentary that a group of us were working on, and I don't know where it is right now in that commentary, but I can give you some sources of that. Let's see if I brought those in. Yeah. You can get some of these. There's a periodical called Biblical Theology Bulletin, and this was a summer issue. It came this past summer. So it would be a 1990 summer issue of that. And there were a series of articles done by Bruce Molina. He has one that I've used in class often, which is quite nice, called Dealing with Biblical, then he puts in parentheses, Mediterranean Characters, a Guide for U.S. Consumers. And of course, what he's saying is that we really have to begin to realize that their culture was quite distinct from our own, and that we're really misreading those texts constantly because we are projecting our culture into their situation. You don't get the impact of the Gospel of Mark unless you realize this kinship and how strong the whole world is organized on that kinship. Whereas for us, it's economic. You probably saw the Seattle Times ran an article on the cost of weddings. The average wedding today is costing $16,000. If you go cheap, it might be six. How they're. So we look at things in terms of, can you afford to get married, you know? But for them, it's a whole different reality. So he has a number of things in here, too, which is rather interesting. Let me read some of this to you, which is just taken from Molina's article. He said, it's unmanly for a father to stay around the house. See, because men are in charge of the public life and world, and women are the ones who are in charge and have the responsibility on the inside. Also, it's unmanly for a father to remain much in the house, to be concerned and involved with child rearing, not to avoid child rearing concerns, to give any child care, to act other than formally and distantly with his children, to be other than remote from his children. As for fathers and daughters, Molina says, we might add here that their lives are rather separated. She is subordinated to his authority, rarely sees him in a situation suitable for interacting, and remains with him only a short time of her lifetime. At the earliest marriageable age, she is surrendered to her in-laws after proper ritual passage focused on the marriage transaction. In comparison to midstream American Bible readers, the Mediterraneans depicted in those texts were expected to be ever vigilant concerning their gender-based behavior. Males were free to express their feelings freely. When they described themselves, they tended to exaggerate. They believed that important events in their lives were caused by persons rather than impersonal causes. Finally, in their conversations, they felt it important to communicate how they felt. Another piece of this is would be this. Fathers alone generate offspring. The whole essence of a newly born boy or girl derives entirely from the father alone. Hence, fathers beget. The mother serves mainly as passive nurturing agent who conceives and bears children. Children are begotten of them or out of them. The image that's used is the seed of the father, which is either potent or impotent, and then there was no way to check whether it was impotent. And then the woman, who was looked upon as the field, and the field was either fruitful or it was barren. And the big thing, of course, was that she would not have relations with anyone before the husband, because then he couldn't be sure whether that was his seed. So that was a very serious thing, so that you can see in even in Mediterranean societies today that having the sheet with the marriage night's sheet with the blood on it was really important to prove that she was a virgin and the children being born are going to be his children and so on. So it's really an important piece of that. Now it's interesting, all of that comes up in biblical text. You can see, say, in the story of in Matthew, not told in Mark, but in the story of Matthew, where it says, and before they came together, she was found to be with child. Now read their big dishonor, big problem ahead. in her society. That what you can see why Joseph decides that he's going to divorce her quietly from his cultural kin. Okay, well, the reason I think this is awfully useful is that when we look then at women today, we can see that they're coming out of a history and a tradition that has asked them to be pretty quiet and to be in the background, and that men are the ones who govern the world. So that we're not going to undo that in a generation or two. But it has very, very deep roots. If you saw that there's an edition of the Time special issue came out in fall, I think. Where did I get this? Yeah, it was fall 1990, Women, the Road Ahead. And they have some statistics here, and it says what youth think. And they were asked various questions here. For instance, it says bringing up baby. If you had the opportunity, would you be interested in staying at home and raising children? The women, 66% say yes, and 33% say no. But still an overwhelming amount say yes. This was rather interesting, though. Men asked, would they like to stay home, and 48% said yes. It's really interesting.
What age group?
This, well, it just says what youth says, so... I imagine, I don't know if it gives us. That's a good question, but I just kind of took it. With who the young people are here, they give an age. Well, I see ages like 21, 26 would be probably in their 20s here. Asked, what of the following is your single most important goal? A successful career. Females said 27% said that was their number one goal, successful career. Males said 32%, which is interesting. A happy marriage, 39% of the women said that was their major goal, a happy marriage. 30% of the males. Well-adjusted children, 23% of the females said that would be their number one goal, only 9% of the men. See, but I think that's a reflection now. If traditionally men were in charge of the outside and not having much to do with their children was really strongly encouraged in that text. And you can see now why when the women in the Gospel of Mark bring the little children to Jesus to bless the children, what do his disciples say? Because from their point of view, that was very unmanly. They didn't want Jesus to. Now, the text then is a really powerful text. For Jesus to spend time with the children is really significant because children have practically no power within that society. They are at the disposal of their parents. So it says something really powerful, I think, about Jesus and how he viewed himself, how he responded. And it asks you then where Jesus got a sense of his own self from. Whereas it seems to me it might be our tendency, and certainly you could say for them, to have a sense of themselves from being male. Jesus somehow or other is able to let go of some of that in a rather significant way. Okay, well, then bringing us to the moments of a woman's journey. It helps, I think, realize what history is there for a woman to come to terms with. And also, I think, then, to read the biblical text in a more enlightened way. The moments of a woman's journey I have in that little booklet, I've taken that from Carol Crisp's book, as I told you. And what she did is she looked at women's novels and women's poetry. And I was at a workshop that she gave some years ago, and what she shared with us is that when she was working with that group, this would have been in the early 80s, She had given some workshops, I think, in one of the Scandinavian countries. And it was the women that she was working with that told her that there were actually four moments that she was identifying through the work she was doing with these various women authors. And these are the four that she came along with. Nothingness, awakening, insight, and new naming. Those were the four. So I have started actually a folder on those, and I'm kind of collecting examples of nothingness, you know, what I mean by that, or what that feeling is. Just so happened that when I went to this workshop with Carol Chris, that was a word that somehow reverberated with the experience I was having at the time. Now, part of that was because I was the first woman professor on an all-male faculty of men. And it wasn't because they were out to give me that message. It was simply that when I would say something, they didn't know what to do with it. So I would say it, and then there would be a pause, and then they would pick up the conversation that was left off before I said something. And after several years of that, of course, I was really struggling. And part of it, again, and I think it's good for men to realize it, I grew up in a family with a father that I got along with and I was very, very close to, and three brothers. And there was a lot of give and take in my family. And oftentimes I think what can happen is I can be treated with respect and listened to and all of that in my house. But once I come out, I'm unprepared to deal with people who don't respect me, because I never had to defend myself in that way. I was always listened to. I always had, and I think the same is true of my nieces and nephews. But then, when I leave, I'm in real trouble. And I've had a real struggle with even, I mean, it always takes me about a day later to realize I've been insulted or I haven't been listening to. Anyway, these are just a couple pieces of this. This is a little piece that came out from Ann Lander. She had this. And it's based on a study that was done at the University of Colorado surveying 2,000 children. And the question they were asked: if you woke up tomorrow and discovered you were a boy or a girl, the opposite of whatever you were, how would your life be different? Mm-hmm. Says Ann Landers, the responses were startling. There was a serious lack of respect for females. In fact, they were held in contempt by both sexes. Many girls said if they were boys, their lives would be better economically and status-wise, and they would enjoy more freedom and have a better time with less responsibility. One girl said, if I were a boy, my father might have loved me more. Boys felt that if they had to be girls, they must be beautiful and know how to put on makeup and dress well. I thought this was great. Quote, no one would be interested in my brain. Well, responded.
What age group is this?
Yeah. Let's see. They were children in grade school, it says. It's actually, it was a study done, it's reported in the February issue of Red Book. This would be in 1983. And I don't know if she's specific, but they're in grade school. There's grade school, a lot of children. Says when boys considered the possibility that females could marry and work outside the home, the jobs they listed most often were secretaries, nurses, cocktail waitresses, social workers, models, airline stewardess, and prostitutes. So, you know, they watch TV. The authors of the study said boys still see women in roles as serving others. The girls envisioned a variety of exciting career possibilities for themselves if they were boys. Most often mentioned were professional athletes, auto mechanics, construction workers, pilots, engineers, forest rangers, stuntmen, coal miners, sportscasters, and farmers. What a rich variety of people. It says many girls realized that one disadvantage of being male was stoicism. If I were a boy, I would have to stay calm and cool whenever something happened. I would not be allowed to express my true feelings. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting how much they've already picked up. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, when he says they wouldn't be interested in my brain, In this study, again, now these are people in their 20s then, and this asked which of the following is an essential requirement for a spouse. Being physically attractive, females said 19% of their choice would be that their mate would have to be physically attractive. But for males, it was 41%. That's really high. Mm-hmm. But again, it seems to me it has to do with the woman being good looking brings honor to the man. It's not just what he thinks, it's what other people think. Having a beautiful wife is, you know, still within the culture, pretty strong, it seems to me, if you have 20 years old. That's one piece. You have to see how far I'm getting along here. What time do we quit again? 5:30, right? I better hustle along here. This is from a friend of mine. She wrote this to me, and it's about her little son, Petey. She said, "I must tell you of an innocent, in quotation marks, incident that happened when you were here. Pete was competing in the local track meet. There were no boys except he entered in the 100 meter dash. So they put the boys and girls in his age group together. He the only boy versus five girls." She says, "Needless to say, he won by a healthy margin. The next day, I was in the kitchen when his Aunt Mary called, and he was telling her he won the 100 meter. Then he added, there was no one else in the race." She obviously couldn't believe that. So his next comment was, "Well, there were some people, about 10 girls, I think." This is someone, again, who's 9, 10 years old, who's discounted a girl. One hopes he meets a girl who runs faster than him. The other story is really poignant. It's a story of a woman. She told me this herself. She was the wife of a pastor for years and years, and he had now just retired. And she had attended a workshop for women, and the leader of the workshop invited them to imagine themselves as being held by their father as little babies. So she put her arms out like this and was imagining she being held by her father. And she started to cry, and she cried so hard and so long that they stopped the entire workshop, and the leader had to somehow work with her. And the story that came out is that her father was a Lutheran minister and had wanted very much that his first child would be a Lutheran minister. And of course, his first child was a girl who could never be a minister, at that time at least. And she lived with that rejection her whole life. So it's those are the moments that begin the journey, in a certain sense, for women. That they're coming to terms with the culture in which they live. And even if they've been sheltered, at some point, that comes home to them. It comes home in lots and lots of different ways. In the Gospel of Mark, let me give you some examples of texts that I think would help, again, women locate this for themselves, that experience. Got to find a little thing here. Got too much stuff here. I know these texts, so. The text we talked about yesterday, for instance, would be one where 500 men, that would be a text where the women don't appear. That would be a nice one. Also, someone has, that's why I really do need this thing here so I can give you the numbers on this, of in the Gospel of Mark, the numbers on the people who are named in the Gospel and those who are not named in terms of women. Well, now that is here someplace, isn't it? Didn't you see that here? Did I stick that?
Are we talking about the level of nothingness?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to give an example of that?
Yeah.
not, she's just using the word nothingness as all of a sudden, it could be that you're second rate, that you're not as important.
Also, that's earliest, the woman's earliest cognitive identification by the dominant society is nothingness.
It is, I think, what it, is that through the culture, women internalize the message that they aren't as important. That's the idea. Okay. And it, of course, comes, the message, I think, is the subliminal message. So that even in American culture where, quote, everyone is equal, the message is really that, you know, men are more equal than women are. And the journey then, the women's journey somehow begins with coming to terms with that in their lives. Now, not that you haven't had a journey before that. You certainly have had a journey before. But there's a sense in which the spiritual quest comes with that recognition. That's so important to come to terms with for a woman. Now, I can't... Oh, here he is. All right. Here's a text. In the Gospel of Matthew, someone has added this up. Five women are given names in the entire Gospel. Only in the names of five women, as compared with 25 men. So we have the names of 25 men in the Gospel, only five women. Then there are eight women who are anonymous in the Gospel, but 16 men who are anonymous. So totally, you have 13 women, individual women, are referred to in the Gospel of Mark, 54 men. So it's one, the proportion is something like one to five. So it's overwhelming. Now that's still better than Life magazine, which just came out with the 100 most significant people who have influenced our lives. And in that list, only 11 women remain. So it's just interesting to see. Someone did this, I can't find it now, a list of the number of entries in Britannica Encyclopedia. It's something like 550 men have little stories about them as being important in history and so on, and like 32 women. So that's how, again, you kind of come to terms with that. Lots of other stories. The second is awakening. The second moment of the woman's journey is awakening. And one of my students gave me this, which I thought was just lovely, about a woman coming to understand herself in a new way. And the metaphors that are used for this moment in the journey are sleep and waking. It's like you were asleep until this and now you're awake. Or you were in bondage and now you're free. You were in the darkness and now you're in light. You were unreal and now you're getting real. I think it has to do with the fact that at some point, women devise a false self. That the expectations of them as women become really what their outside projects, or what they project to the outside. So something inside goes dead. In Carol Crisp's book, she highlights that for the journey of conversion, for men is giving up something, but for women has to be gaining something because they've lost something earlier. So what it means again is that we have to look at the images and symbols and metaphors within our religious tradition to see whether some of those will be better for women and some will be better for men, and we have to be sure that we're not crossing and getting those mixed up, it seems to me. Like women don't need usually to hear to give up their selves. What they need to see is that they have to have a self before they can let go of that. So there are a lot of issues around that. One of the books that I have found really very useful is this book called The Girl Within. And what she deals with, this is a woman who did a dissertation on women. And then after she did that, she did her doctoral research, Then she went back and she looked at that material that she had gathered, and she says that as she went back and looked at the material, she found that the women who went through some kind of process to come to know themselves and had a better sense of themselves, at some point rediscovered the girl within. She said they themselves were distressed to find that they had lost her, a disturbing insight that often came to them unbidden when they confronted the contrived self that had stolen in to take her place. They were unprepared to find that the task of a woman's lifetime boils down to reclaiming the authentic identity she had embodied as a girl. Although the details differed among women in the study, each who described her experience in depth spoke of this striking phenomenon, the inner girl lost and reclaimed. This radical finding, she says, gives rise to provocative questions. How is this girl lost or buried in the first place? What is her importance in a woman's adult identity? And how is it possible that these women apparently managed to live responsible, effective lives, marrying, having children, in many cases pursuing careers, going along just as they had a solid sense of self, until they suddenly found that they had lost their real self and came to rely on the trappings of a self instead. In other words, there's a lot of work here for many women. And then she gives examples of books, for instance, that have been written about this experience of the girl within. She says, who is the girl within? What deep truth does she possess? Poised between the make-believe of preschool and the thrall of adolescence, the 8 to 10-year-old occupies an intermediate zone of childhood, a space between fantasy and reality that fosters creative self-ownership. Mm-hmm. A child of 8 enjoys a wholeness of self, a unity with the cosmos, a natural radiance. The unity and radiance of the golden ball that appears in so many fairy tales. Nature and society, you could say, and religion conspire to allow a girl to flourish, and harmony and integrity abound. Playful yet purposeful, girls of this age have opened the gate to the age of reason. Practically old hands at school, they are already reading and calculating, playing group games, acquiring athletic skills, and absorbing the rules of their young society. The rapid development of a girl's mind, the acceleration of her know-how, the shift in the way she thinks at this time are acknowledged by cultures and religions throughout the world. And then she gives a number of stories, some of the Harriet the Spy, for instance, if you know that as a story. Ruth Sawyer's Roller Skates. I mean, it's just wonderful. She mentions Caddy Woodlong. I don't know if you remember that story that girls had. But she says that we shouldn't get too excited about those wonderful examples, because she says, in fact, children's literature is sodden with pretty perfect useless girls. And many girls, that's the overwhelming message that they hear. But there are examples of this kind of independence and this wonderful growing.
This is Emily, the author?
The Emily Hancock.
Oh, is that
must be on that list there.
Okay.
Yeah. But that would be part of that second moment of reclaiming, coming back, of awakening. In the Gospel of Mark, we won't have time now, but in chapter 5, verses 21 to 33, is a story of the hemorrhaging woman and the daughter of Jairus. And that story, I think, or those two stories together, are stories that I think have a whole lot of power for women to come to terms with their little girl, with the girl within. The father who really goes out of his way to have Jesus come and heal his daughter, and then meets the woman who's had an issue of blood for 12 years, which is probably how old the daughter is. She's just on the threshold of puberty. And here's a woman who's been suffering from that condition for 12 years. It's a very evocative story, and I've read many women, scholars and otherwise, really, that story really touching their lives. And It's a really powerful story. I might mention, however, that I had a student this summer, a male student, who also used that story and used it very, very powerfully. So I wouldn't want you to think that a story can only be used by a male or female. It has to do with your experience and getting in touch with that experience and how the biblical text can help you in that process. And the hemorrhaging woman has been a really potent symbol, I think, for women. But it also works for men in various ways. Okay, so that would be an awakening there. And you see that image of the girl was asleep. They thought she was dead, and Jesus raises her from the dead. And it's this wonderful line at the end where they're all standing around, you know, astonished. And Jesus tells her to give her something to eat. That's just a wonderful line in the story. The third moment is insight. And I think the major insight for women is self-care. Self-care, that they have to treasure themselves. That means they have to treasure their time, their energy. Women have to know that they've lost a lot of time oftentimes, so they have to make up for it now. I have some wonderful jokes along that line. This is by, this is a cute one I've kept. It's a woman is standing there. This is, Hollander.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The woman says, I resolve to be more loving and kind, and to put my ego aside when your need is greater than mine. And the next picture says, but not this year. See? It means she's come to see that she has work to do. It's really important that she does this work. And if women are always going to be nice and understanding and giving, they're not going to be able to do the work that they need to do. It's really important, I think, for women to come to that. Here's another one. Now, this is written. This is comes from Japan from the year 834. This is a 9th century poem. It says, doesn't he realize that I am not like the swaying kelp in the surf? Where the seaweed gatherer can come as often as he wants. Doesn't he realize that I am not like the swaying kelp in the surf? Where the seaweed gatherer can come as often as he wants. The hardest thing for women is to have boundaries. The hardest, in my department, someone asked me to do something, I say yes, probably without thinking. And it always amazes me. I can ask one of the guys I work with, and he'll say no as quick. And I'm always kind of pull back. And it's really an intelligent thing to do sometimes, is to say no. You know? But it has to do with, I think, a sense of oneself and boundaries and where one's obligations are. So that would be the third. And then the fourth one is the renaming. I was going to share you one other thing that a student of mine gave me, which I think is quite nice on this. I probably lost it right now. Oh, here it is. On awakening, she says, the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the door still where the two worlds meet. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. How hard it is for women to remain true to their insights and to their own self. This is a poem actually by Rumi. Yeah. Okay, the fourth moment then is renaming. I have two things I want to share with you here. One is a poem by Daniel Berrigan. It's called Revelation. And again, I think because men have been so determinative of the public life, culturally, the ones who certainly have done the most writing in the Hebrew scriptures and in the New Testament. They must appear. I mean, it's just that's the way it is because of the time in which it was written and so on. There are then few images and symbols, metaphors, that pick up on women's experience. But here's one that does, and it's called Revelation, after Juliana of Norwich. Then showed me he, in right hand held, everything that is. The hand was a woman's. Creation all lusty, a meek bird's egg, nesting there waiting. Her word, and I heard it. Newborn, I make you. Nestling, I love you. Homing, I keep you. Now, as a matter of fact, those images are the earliest images we have for the divine and for the sacred. The earliest images we have are of the fertility gods, where the woman's breasts are filled with milk and she's pregnant with new life. Those are the earliest images that we have. I think what we see then through the Hebrew scriptures is that when the experience of Yahweh came, then the goddess images were either destroyed or put in opposition to God or to the divine, and because of God being one. And then some of those were taken up into the images of God within the Hebrew scriptures. And then I think you can see within the New Testament, Jesus really comes as bring some of those same images back, say when he says, I would have gathered you as a hen gathers with these strong images. Or in the Gospel of Matthew, by the way, is really strong with some of those very feminine images. So it's really important, I think, for women to find some of those images to identify the feminine with the sacred and the divine, since our tradition is weighed so heavily against it. And unless women can do that, they won't find much help. So I think it's right. Now, in my little book, The Gospel of Mark, this is my book, and I really should have brought copies along. I have a chapter in here called Healing. I think that's the chapter. No, this is the one actually called The Power. And what I did in this chapter is I talked about the miracles, of course, and what miracles are, and so on in the Gospel of Mark. But I took the story of the Gerasene demoniac. And when I was doing research on that story, which is so wonderful, it has all these wonderful images in that story. I was reading at the same time an article on women's experience. And the article, I actually was going to do this in a group with you because you could work this out too. Let me just see if I can find that. Maybe it is in the healing chapter. Oh, it is in the healing chapter. The name of this article is called The Sin of Hiding by Susan Nelson Dunphy. And it just happened that as I was doing this research on the Gerasene demoniac, I was reading this article, and some of the same language appeared. And here are some of the... She describes in this... her article about women's experience, she says, violence is being etched into the secret lives of women who turn against themselves in self-hatred. She describes woman as cut off from herself, denying her full humanity, hiding in a deformed existence, alienated from others, and living a submerged existence. Now, those are all phrases in her article describing women's experience, but they seem to be pretty much the same images that occur in the story of the Gerasene demoniac. The kind of self-hatred, he hits himself, remember. They bind him with chains so that he will be controlled and won't destroy himself, because that's what he's really trying to do. And he bursts those chains, and he has a power
that is against him, if you will.
Karen, can you just give us the reference on that story so we can look it up and look at the images? The Gerasene demoniac?
Okay. It's in, we can look at
five,
that.
5, 1 through 20.
Yeah, right. Chapter 5. Verse
1 through
20. Yeah, 1 through 20. So, and it's really descriptive. I mean, it's a wonderful story. This describes, it says, they came across, came to the other side of the sea, to the territory of the Gerasenes. When he got out of the boat, at once a man from the tombs who had an unclean spirit met him. The man had been dwelling among the tombs, and no one could restrain him any longer, even with a chain. But notice how the tombs and the chains and all of that comes with him. And becomes, again, I think, an image of what one can do to oneself in the text. And then, of course, as the story goes on, I think you can see an awakening. It comes with naming. And there are contrary voices. And often women have a false voice. I say things and I wonder, you know, it's, I'm mouthing this and I thought, I don't even believe this. I mean, you know, I'm old enough or I'm, it's coming out, I think, who is this that's talking, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's stuff I've learned. It's tape recorded, you know?
Karen, give a description again of the renaming.
Okay, so the renaming really is renaming your experience and also renaming the things within your tradition. In this case, the example I used is of Berrigan renaming Revelation using feminine images. And you see how seldom that is done. But they're there, and they need to be simply lifted up and evoked and claimed, if you will, renaming. I have another example that I could give you. This is a poem by a student of mine that's been published. It's called Grandpa H. You came by train from North Dakota every 5 years. Dad bought boxes of apples for strudel. Round and round the table, Mom and Grandma stooped, stretching the dough inch by inch, thin as an altar cloth, cinnamon, sugar, raisins, walnuts, a benediction. You dropped your teeth at me by the gray stone fence, and I went shaking to set the table. After supper, all the adults spoke loud German and played pinochle, laughing in the smoke. My brothers and I teased at you, outran your lunging arms. But the year my breasts began, you caught me in the basement, your hands upon my chest. You squeezed and squeezed. Where'd you get them apples, huh? I heard of your death in my third year of marriage. I need to tell you, leave my apples alone. Now, a lot of the, it comes out of that situation of abuse that stayed with her. See, and until you rename that, until you claim that and name that again. See, she needed to say that when she was a child and couldn't. So now she needs to say that. So that's what the renaming is.